Roguecast is the official podcast of Rogues Gallery Comics and Games. Every week we talk about new comic releases, store news, and whatever games, movies, and TV is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
This is Dave.
I'm Nick.
And now, on with the show. Welcome to Roguecast, episode 260. Last week, we did not record, and so the women of Rogues Gallery stepped in for us.
Yes.
And they stepped in and talked about Pride Month.
Yes.
They talked about mental illness in comics, and they spent roughly 10 minutes hating on my favorite Marvel movie, Avengers Endgame.
But that apparently theirs was basically more thematic and not our sort of hyper structured format,
right?
Or that is to say, they structured it around themes,
right?
As
yes.
opposed to our pop culture review each week,
right? But the important thing is that their opinions of Avengers Endgame do not represent our opinions of Avengers Endgame. That's important for me to note. That is not how I feel about Avengers Endgame.
Just know that Avengers Endgame, when it hits on digital, it will probably be played in the store constant.
Yes.
Loop.
Also,
I don't want a bunch of people weeping in the store.
Sure we do.
Alright, so coming up this summer, we've got Magic the Gathering 2020 Open House on Saturday, June 29th. More details on that hopefully coming this week. They're about to unembargo some of the cards and stuff, so we'll just see a preview. We are going to close early on Tuesday, July 2nd, so that I can go see Spider-Man Far From Home. We had been scheduled, but then Kate has left us. As we say, tragically, Kate is no longer with us. And so
happily, Kate is at a job she likes.
Kate is at a job she likes. So we're going to close at 6 p.m. on Tuesday, July 2nd, just for people to know, and we won't have D&D that night. Then on the first weekend in July, Friday, July 5th, Saturday, July 6th, and Sunday, July 7th, we will have four Magic the Gathering Core 2020 pre-releases.
That's nuts.
There's room for a lot of people. We need to get people signed up, hopefully, but if you ever want to come out for a Magic pre-release, this is a good one. It's for their core set. Probably going to be a little more friendly to newer players. You just got to come and build a deck, and this will be the new core set. So...
You should come out, and you should grab that friend who kind of wanted to try Magic and make them come out,
yep.
too.
That'll be played on Friday night, Saturday night, and then Sunday during the day, and then during the evening. All Ages Awesomeness has been officially announced. We've got our lineup, we got our timeline. That's Saturday, July 13th. All the details are on the website. That's Sunday, July 14th. There'll be a Final Fantasy Opus 9 pre-release if you're playing the Final Fantasy TCG. Kate is, tragically, no longer with us, but she is still running the Final Fantasy TCG for us.
But as soon as it's over, she will no longer be with
yes.
us. Until the next Final Fantasy game, where she just stops by.
That's right. There's a Magic the Gathering Commander weekend coming up in August. Don't know much about that yet, but just keep that on your radar. All right, news. I think there's a lot of video game news this week.
Well, E3 happened.
So one of the things that was then, this is not technically video game news, but it's video game to movie. The Uncharted movie is not going to star Nathan Fillion, as I think everyone hoped.
Yeah.
It's instead going to star Tom Holland, and it's going to release in winter 2020.
So they went the opposite. Nathan Fillion, who's, I presume, like 60 now.
Yep.
He's like 50.
No, he's 75.
75, Randy said it, so yeah. That's probably true.
Yeah.
And then there's Tom Holland, who I believe just turned 12.
That's correct.
Is this were y'all telling me off mic that this will be about a younger Nathan Drake?
Well, said something about it.
I think
know.
It's gonna play a little bit into what they did in Uncharted 3, which is they had a kind of a younger adventure of Drake and Sully.
Like, right, you sort of saw their flashbacks.
Yeah,
I mean, it would sort of make sense since their friendship is kind of at the heart of those games. To sort of build it from the ground up and let Tom Holland grow into the role,
yeah.
rather than have actor who's not a 12-year-old play him and then have to do a flashback and hire a 12-year-old.
Yep.
I think if you want to see Nathan Fillion be Nathan Drake, go watch that. I think it's like a 20-minute-long movie that he made as Nathan Drake as in Uncharted. That is actually very, very good.
Did he do that just as kind of to try and push for the role?
I don't know if he did it or if he just was like, oh, they want me to do this? This sounds fun. Let's do it.
Yeah, it sounds in this article that I'm reading from Screen Rant that basically Tom Holland was suggested about 2 years ago. He suggested a young Nathan Drake approach. And then they have a new director. The director they brought in is Dan Trachtenberg, who directed 10 Cloverfield Lane.
Okay. I thought that movie was great.
It's going to be in December 2020. Screen Rant does note that that's interesting because this is the first December that we've had in a while with no Star Wars, no Avatar, no DC movie in it. And that also that there's no, this is not cast news or anything, but Holland has suggested that he would really like for Jake Gyllenhaal or Chris Pratt to play Sully.
Be interesting.
Jake Gyllenhaal or Chris Pratt. Okay, yeah, I said Sully would be younger in those days.
I kind of would want Jake Gyllenhaal.
You know, here's the thing. Of the two he suggested, I feel like Chris Pratt feels more like Sully's character. Gyllenhaal doesn't seem like that.
How much older is Sully than Nathan Drake? Isn't he a little older?
Yeah, like 20, 25 years.
Yep. So maybe Nathan Fillion should play Sully.
Except Sully, like, personality-wise, what is he compared to? Like, what...
He's like a Paul Newman kind of character.
Like like Paul Newman when he was like 58 or something. Yeah,
so let's
like
get
that.
Paul Newman out of retirement and let's DH him.
Yeah.
De-aging makeup.
I mean, Paul Newman's dead, so we'd
let's get him out of retirement.
What if we use the CG of Princess Leia from Rogue One?
Yes.
Tweak it slightly so it looks like Paul Newman.
Yep.
So here's the weird thing about it. I really like the Uncharted games. I liked playing as the young Nathan Drake in the third one. I really don't know if I want that in a movie. Like, I don't know if I want Baby Drake.
I want there to be a fun Uncharted movie that actually delivers on what the potential could be.
Does it actually have that potential is what I'm worried about. Is like, I feel like it's good. It's super great interactive experience, but he's not quite Indiana Jones. He's not like a scholar adventurer. He's very much more like what do you call it? Why can't I say the actor's name? Firefly guy.
Nathan Fillion.
I keep mixing him up with our customer, various customers.
Jeffrey Fillion and Nathan Fillion.
Yes, those guys will perpetually trip me up, even though we don't see them that often these days.
Nope.
Anyway, Nathan Fillion. I think he got that scoundrel quality,
yeah.
And Nathan Drake has that quality in the games, but he's not like a scholar the way Indiana Jones is.
No, but he's not dumb. He's not like a meathead or anything.
No.
He's in the game quoting like random facts about some naval mission that happened.
He also just as often has lines that make him out to be kind of a bit of a doofus,
right?
Now, what do you do to make this movie work other than have like a strong script to it? Like, how does it differentiate itself from Raiders of the Lost Ark and all the Tomb Raiders kind of ones out there?
Yeah. I don't know, but I think that you have the ability, and mainly it's because the games are so cinematic. I mean, they are larger than life and fun and always include some horror element. I mean, not unlike the Tomb Raider games.
There is some supernatural stuff usually that crops up, even though there's not a ton of it. It's a little bit like Raiders of the Lost Ark in the sense that there was, like, only supernatural stuff near the end, kind of.
I don't know.
Yeah, I hope it does well. Tom Holland's a good actor. I'm just not quite sold on the idea yet. We'll see.
And I don't care, because I played about 15 minutes of Uncharted. Didn't do it anything for me. So, whatever.
That was Randy's mistake.
Randy missed some good games.
Shows his lack of judgment.
In fairness, I got motion sickness from it and couldn't enjoy it. And I might have blamed it for that.
My constitution was weak. That was me imitating what Randy very likely said circa 2008.
Yes, that's correct. That was exactly what I said.
Yeah.
Also, there was a video game teaser trailer for Baldur's Gate 3, Nick has not watched, but Dave and I have.
And you guys said it's creepy.
Straight up cinematic trailer.
Yeah, and it's just like a dude walking down the streets of Waterdeep and like being like body horror stuff.
Yeah, so Waterdeep, it looks like, I believe, in the background, like there's chaos around him, like fires and, you know, a little bit of, you get almost that vibe I think you get from like zombie plague movies or zombie invasion movies. Where it looks like the town is starting to fall, but you kind of can't tell what's happening in all the mist and smoke and stuff. And then he starts to, like, shape change. But the way it happens, I can only describe it as it being like John Carpenter's The Thing.
Yeah. Hmm.
It looks like this thing is exploding out from inside him. It's weirdly kind of gory. Not, like, super bloody, but the shape changing is disturbing.
Yeah.
And he becomes an Illithid?
Yep, a mind flayer.
A mind flayer, yeah.
At which point you can see a flash in the back, and there's like the big tentacle monster in the sky, and it's clearly like a mind flayer invasion.
Yeah.
From what I understand, I think because you guys were talking about this and with Anna, and she said like there was a add-on to like the game?
To the last Baldur's. So I guess Baldur's Gate 2 had some DLC that had an apocalyptic thing. But I don't know if she said it was like... It was like, it wasn't specifically tied to Mind Flayers or the Far Realms or anything.
It wasn't? Right. I thought it was.
I don't know. I was hazy on exactly what it was. I thought, to me it sounded like what she described didn't necessarily connect with this, but maybe does. I do think it'd be cool if they continue that continuity, because it's always nice when the previous games are taken into account.
Have they said this is going to be on like PS4 and Xbox 360?
Yeah, it's going to be on all of those, I think.
You know, I would like to play a video game set in Waterdeep.
I have not played. No, I know they did a Baldur's Gate the version. They transferred it to the PlayStation. And I think it was more of a shoot 'em up like Gauntlet type thing.
You can get it as an app.
That's the old one. That's the one that they have for PC.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that the ones they had on console were different.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know.
I thought that they had done some kind of Baldur's Gate games were on console, which I didn't play.
I just want to see some cinematic where Minsk punches a Mind Flayer.
Sure.
What do you call it? You know, a few years, like when D&D 4th edition came out, the Forgotten Realms got projected forward 100 years.
Yeah.
And they had like that cataclysm where there were like floating islands and stuff now and all that. Is that still taken into account in 5th edition? Is that the standard?
No idea.
They did, they messed with it. They allowed for that to be the case in the comics, where Minsk and Boo had like died, but were like magically resurrected in it. But it was technically supposed to be 100 years. And I think they just kind of ignored the stuff about the floating islands.
Well, I think everybody hated it.
Everyone
hated that update, yeah.
Yeah. I just wondered if they're like, for the game purposes, they might as well just say that Minsk and Boo are just still around, I guess.
Yeah.
Anyway, a horror kind of themed Waterdeep adventure, or not Waterdeep, but Baldur's Gate, which is not Waterdeep.
I said Waterdeep, but I was wrong.
Holy separate city.
Yep.
It's right there in the title.
Yep.
But I didn't catch it either, because so much is set in Waterdeep.
Yeah.
And a bunch of the recent game modules have been as well. So my big problem with Baldur's Gate when it came out is that it was real time.
Yeah.
And so when the battles happened, you could pause them, but it was like kind of, it felt awkward to me, the pause things. I'd rather, like, it went to kind of a turn-based XCOM thing that did the D&D rules and stuff, like, you know, basically ran the dice numbers for you and had cool visuals to go with it, but more or less played like XCOM and went to turn-based when it happened.
I would like that, too.
That's how the earliest ones were that I got on the Commodore 64 way back when, Pool of Radiance and Curse of the Azure Bonds.
Damn,
and all
you're
that stuff.
Old.
Oh, yeah. Those were good games.
They were good games.
And I feel like you could adapt those the same way they did, like, XCOM was, like, what, 1990 or 91 or something like that? And they updated that very successfully. So I feel like it could be done. But I guess XCOM always was turn-based, and Baldur's Gate has always been not. So that's just sort of my hope. Honestly, I would expect that whatever upgrades they do to it may make it more playable for me, and I hope it does.
I'm definitely interested in it, but...
This was purely a cinematic trailer, incidentally. Yeah, they didn't show any gameplay.
No gameplay at all. No indication of really of anything other than a little
bit. I do not want turn-based. What if XCOM annoys the crap out of me?
What if it's a side-view beat-em-up game where
like
you're
going to... Like Final Fight?
By the way, in defense of XCOM, what my memory is you played it on the level where you could not... there were no saves except...
No,
like
I played it both ways.
Okay. So you were just... you just didn't know how to fight.
Apparently I suck at turn-based, which is fine.
I have a weak constitution. That's my impression of Nick when he's playing XCOM.
I thought you were just doing your own impression.
Randy was just reliving the old days.
Yeah, exactly.
So when he tried to watch a video game and it made tum-tum hurt.
Mine would just show me smashing a controller as XCOM just destroyed my entire insanity.
I recently replayed through the XCOM update. And I really like that game. It pushes almost all the right buttons for me, but it does have some frustrating elements. And there were a few times when I was like, "F this game."
Yeah, I've definitely been in that mode with XCOM, but I love XCOM.
Yeah, when it's good to me, it's like the best.
Yeah.
We shall see.
Yeah.
Nick, have you ever played a D&D game you liked? Video game?
I actually don't know if I have. I don't know if I've played many D&D games,
yeah.
other than like the tabletop. Yeah,
they had some great ones back in the day. It's just been a while.
There was a Baldur's Gate game for the Commodore 64 back in the day that was not good. It had like a bunch of like weird mini games. They also did one of like Hillsfar.
Yeah, I remember Hillsfar. It was not good.
Yeah, there was a Dragonlance one, also not good. Yeah. There was. I believe those early turn-based ones were the only ones that were really notably good.
Yeah, but it was
interesting how much they were pushing them, though. Yeah. Like D&D was a kind of a big video game license in the early or late 80s, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't think I played any of them. I played Dragon's Lair.
It does have a dragon in it.
Yeah. It does.
But anyway, yeah, fingers crossed.
The game I'm super looking forward to, though, is the Cyberpunk 2077. Which we finally got a big old trailer for.
Yeah, it made Keanu Reeves a extra meme. You know, he was already memeing as the savior of our modern day.
Yep.
But then he was like, told the audience that they were breathtaking, I believe.
Yeah.
You seen the clip?
Yep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That somebody's like, you're breathtaking, or whatever. He's like, oh, well, I guess he said this video game's graphics are breathtaking. And someone's like, you're breathtaking. He's like, you're all breathtaking.
Anyway, this game looks amazing. I love the gameplay footage that I watched a few months back that sort of showed somebody going in and doing a shoot-up and all this kind of stuff. And this sort of shows a little bit of the story, which seems to be maybe a street samurai who gets caught up in something bigger and then gets recruited by Johnny Silverhand, one of their rocker boys, one of their big notable characters, played perfectly by Keanu Reeves. I love the Cyberpunk world. And I think the game looks amazing.
Why do you say he played it perfectly?
He just looks like he's the right fit for it.
Okay. I was like, I forget this is an established world.
Yes.
It is not a generic Cyberpunk
game. No, this is Cyberpunk 2020.
It is specifically, I mean, like, that still sounds like it could be a generic name, but it was like the RPG that was the definitive kind of Cyberpunk RPG of its day. Yeah, that's one that was like completely under my radar.
That's so crazy. You meant,
so my brother didn't have it, which like he got like almost every RPG that existed through the 80s, and then in the 90s I wasn't gaming, so no tabletop gaming. So yeah, that one just completely passed me by.
Man, I played so much Cyberpunk. It was like D&D Cyberpunk Champions are my big defining games. So.
Does it work like Shadowrun and so many of those other ones? You're essentially all kind of like. Sort of amoral, heisty guys hacking into systems.
No, actually, I mean, the notion was this came out in the 80s, so it was very much like that the evil corporations were going to take over, and you guys were the sort of proletariat heroes. You were criminals, but you were working for the good for the people of the streets who were being crushed by the corporations. I don't think that those kind of themes are going to resonate in 2019, of course.
We'll just have to sort of try and imagine what it would be like.
What it would be like if corporations and governments were crushing people beneath their heels and you were kind of rooting for criminals against the fascists who were taking everything over. It's hard to imagine.
We'll try.
Yeah.
We can only try. But the graphics, of course, look amazing.
Oh, it looks so good.
I'm not a big cyberpunk genre guy, but it looks like you're going to have all kinds of cool things you can do, whether it's like... augments to yourself, hacking into system, taking over like security weapons and stuff, I think, you know, all kinds of...
And you're going to build your own character in this, right?
Yeah.
Which I've heard some pretty cool stuff.
It looks like, I mean, the guys who did this did, what, Witcher, I think? Or something like Witcher 3? It's like, these guys have done a game...
That's a pretty beloved
people
game.
People love.
I'm going to build another hacker in the game. I will do Zero Cool from Hackers, and I will run around and say, hack the planet!
So let's see. Trying to figure this out. That Hackers took place in what year? 1990?
Oh, it was like 95?
Let's say 95. So in 2020, he would be 25 years older?
Yeah, somewhere in there.
Right?
Yeah.
You should do that exactly, Nick, and just imagine...
I will model a Johnny Lee Miller.
He could be like, could have been like the guy who like kind of fell out of as technology progressed past what he knew. But it's called back because they need the original hacker god.
Okay, but this is Cyberpunk 2077, so he's going to be real damn old.
So the original game was 2020?
Yeah.
Back when 2020 seemed like a far-flung future?
Yes. Not next year.
You know what? They have nanotech. They have all kinds of...
Sure.
They could have grown a new body. It still should. You should still do it, Nick.
I will.
You guys aren't allowed to play this game. Only people who like Cyberpunk get to play this game.
I've never played a Cyberpunk game.
Anyway, I don't know. It's getting a bit of nostalgia for me. Like, I was going to play this even if it looked crappy.
Yeah.
But it looks amazing. And everybody I know who's into video games is like, this is the game they're all looking forward to.
Yeah.
And it comes out the day before my birthday. So I'm very excited.
I have a feeling I will buy this just, yeah. I mean, on a, yeah, on
this,
a whim.
I buy like two or three games a year, and this is definitely going to be one of them.
This is apropos of nothing but tied into E3 announcements. There was a game that looked interesting to me that's for the upcoming Google Cloud-based game system. Do y'all know about this?
Weird.
I don't remember what it's called even. And I don't know if there will be hardware sold or whether this will be accessed through extant things like iPads and computers. I don't know. Anyway, the game, though, was interesting looking. Kind of, it almost looked like family horror game.
A family horror game.
That is to say, the designs looked like a Pixar movie.
Oh, okay.
And it was called, I think, Guilt, like G-Y-L-T. I don't know if that's a name of somebody or something. But the vibe I got was that it looked like this. The character she gets, like, trapped in a school after dark, and there's, like, creepy things going on, and it's all maybe takes place in and around this. But it did look like as if Pixar had made the horror movie.
Interesting.
Anyway, it was, I think, primarily a cinematic trailer and didn't show the gameplay. So, and between that and the fact that I know nothing about the whatever the system will be, it's definitely a who knows, but it looked cool to me. It I think it'd be kind of fun to do something like that.
All right, leaving E3 and going over to the weird movie thing, I didn't see this trailer, but apparently there's a trailer for Banana Splits, and it's pretty bonkers.
Yeah, it's for sci-fi, I think. If I'm not mistaken, it's not a theatrical release.
No, it's not a theatrical. It's
Well, but it also wasn't it wasn't Sharknado-level campy.
I don't know. It kind of had that level of insanity. But
I guess it didn't look like there were, it didn't have the CG that's so bad it's funny kind of vibe of it. But yes, the Banana Splits, the weird live-action people in animal suit. Was it Sid Marty Krofft? If it wasn't, it was inspired by that kind of hallucinatory, slightly creepy children's shows like H.R. Puff and stuff.
I thought it was weird when they crossed over with Suicide Squad not too long ago. But this is actually weirder, this trailer.
Well, there's almost a pedigree because way back, and it's tied to comics again. The first trailer for one of the Red Band trailer for Hitman had a punk rock Ramones style version of the Banana Splits theme song while Hit Girl carved people up. They used that in the movie, I think.
Oh, okay.
It was just a straight up scene from it. So there's already a little bit of crossover into weird dark territory. And yes, in short, it looks like the Banana Splits are like creepy. Oh, it looks like Five Nights at Freddy's creepy.
Yeah, it basically looks like they get stuck in a Chuck E. Cheese, and...
Wait, are they actually... They're not actually in a Chuck E. Cheese, are they?
It looked like kind of Daddy Land kind of style place.
Oh, okay. I guess I thought it was... I thought it was still, like, in a TV studio or something.
No. I thought it looked like kind of like that, and...
By the way, for just a second, I thought you said Daddy Land. And I'm like, you probably don't want to Google that online.
No, I said maybe you do. You I do said what you want. Daddy Land.
All right.
Anyways, they get stuck in there.
That's even more Five Nights at Freddy's. That's a ripoff of Five Nights at Freddy's at that point.
And the Banana Splits go on a murderous rampage as they kill all the people inside.
Yeah.
It looks bizarre. I mean, it looks like Z-level effects and things like that.
I didn't actually remember enough of the effects to recall that. I guess that does make it very sci-fi.
It is very schlocky, it looks. I don't know if I will be seeking this one out.
Yeah. It'd have to be kind of inspiredly weird or something like that. I won't tune in for They're So Bad It's Good. I've never really been a big fan of that.
But 10 years from now, I can see it being like a cult classic.
Right. I will say this, I think I saw maybe one or two people, on Friends of Friends, who were like, oh no, they've ruined the Banana Splits. But I believe primarily there is not a strong following for the Banana
Splits. I was going
to
say, most people are going to be like, the Banana Who's?
Or they remember them and they were like, yeah, that was weird.
It's not like they're making a horror version of Hong Kong Phooey.
I don't know. Who can even guess?
Yeah.
If you are familiar with the Banana Splits and have thoughts on this, please write us saying, I know the Banana Splits in your subject line.
Mm-hmm. All right, moving on to something else I have no interest in. Dune, the Denis Villeneuve, is doing the movie for Dune. I've never been a Dune fan. I've got no particular interest. But they're doing a companion TV series for it that is... What's the deal on this? It's like some crazy...
It's a companion show?
Yeah, it's going to be...
It's about the Bene Gesserit. Sisterhood. It's about the Bene Gesserit.
The Bene Gesserit. They're an ancient order of women who have mastered their minds and bodies through mental condition to gain superhuman powers.
I remember they were going to try this with the Dark Tower stuff, and look how well that went.
Yeah.
So, all right. Interesting.
Yeah, they've had the chance to learn the lessons, and they are putting, like, so much kind of star power behind this that, like, if they don't...
Feels like everyone is involved in Denis Villeneuve's Dune.
I think I have a small part in it. I don't even know.
I play a sandworm. Briefly. Yeah, I was the tank.
Hey, if they came and asked me and be a part of the sandworm, I'd be a part of the sandworm.
It works just like a horse costume. Somebody plays the head, somebody plays the tail.
And then Batman shoots it.
They CG the rest. nice how you worked in the Batman.
Yeah, I was waiting for it, actually.
I don't even know what to think about this. I am a casual fan of Dune, but not...
Which makes you the biggest Dune fan in the room.
but not a big fan of Denis Villeneuve. Is that how you say it?
Yeah.
Or you say Villanueva?
I say Villanueva, but I don't know what's correct.
All right.
Yeah.
Denis Villa.
Only one good movie.
I hope this comes off. It seems a little early to be making a TV show as well. I believe it probably takes into account, like, some of the various Dune sequels and or prequels, about which I've kind of sometimes heard, stay the hell away.
How many prequels and sequels have there been?
I don't know. All I know is that a friend was... I've seen two friends who are big into Dune, who are enthusiastic about it,
do they have sandworm costumes in their closets?
Probably. yeah, my co-podcaster for Tex Trek, our Star Trek podcast... said that he thinks it's a better fit for TV, and I can see that. It's a big kind of epic scope thing, so the same way you wouldn't want, like, a Game of Thrones, just a movie or two or whatever. The weird thing is I heard somebody, like a friend of his, who was the other enthusiast, talking about some prequel novels or something, and I thought mentioned Kevin Anderson as the writer of
them. Oh, nice.
Yeah.
And that guy is like the dude
Kevin J. Anderson, guy who wrote all the Star Wars novels?
Yeah, a bunch of Star Wars and like X-Files and stuff like that.
Yeah, the guy never seen a license he can't write and write wrong.
You know what he should do? Adapt the Banana Splits murderous movie.
It's weird you say that, because I actually remember liking his Star Wars ones.
Don't reread them.
Oh, okay.
Because I liked them at the start, but by the end of it, especially compared to like Timothy Zahn stuff, it doesn't feel like Star Wars.
Okay.
He has this tiny little ship that destroys suns, and that is not a Star Wars thing.
No, that's not
like
a Star Wars
thing. There's a lot of stuff in that Kevin J. Anderson where I think we were so starved for Star Wars material, and he was writing these familiar characters, but don't go back to them.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know what his overall writing skill is, and presumably Doom would be him being much more ambitious than his like top books, but yeah, I have no idea.
I'm sure he wrote like a sandworm that could destroy suns.
We can only assume. Who knows?
All right.
Who knows?
A couple bits of comic news we want to talk about. There is a Harleen limited series coming out from DC Comics on their Black Label imprint, which means it's going to be in the giant format, just like the Superman Year One that hits this week.
Yep. And it's both a retelling and reimagining of Harleen?
Yeah, reimagining of her origin. None of this sounded interesting to me until I realized, as Dave posted, that it's by Stefan Sechnik.
Right, who we know as the creator of the comic Sunstone for Image, his kind of naughty comic, but like thoughtful naughty comic. He's a really talented artist. He did a really amazing arc on Aquaman where he just like redesigned everything from the ground up, and it looked stunning.
The preview pages look fantastic on this.
Yeah, there's like scenes of other Arkham villains. There's scenes of Harley and Joker. And I just from what I know from like little casual sketches and little vignettes he's drawn just for his own personal entertainment, He is definitely a guy who's extremely aware of the kind of the abusive nature of Joker's and Harley's relationship, and who's like would be a champion of the Harley Ivy evolution.
Yeah.
So whatever he's gonna do in rethinking that or relensing it, I think will probably be a smart take on it.
I hope so.
I think honestly that, and they won't do this, but they should just let him do the sort of sexy DC things that he's done pinups of.
Yeah.
Like
Wonder Woman,
miniseries.
Tomb Raider relationship.
The relationship he does with like Superman and Lois. And
Like,
those pinups he does of the relationships where it's like it shows them having like more intimate moments. I'm like, That is what Stephen Sedgwick is good at. It would be an interesting thing to do.
Yeah.
They'll never do it because they won't even show us Batman's dick. As we're
I was going to say, the same person who was afraid of Batman's dick is going to be afraid of Lois and Clark
who's
having intimate...
That is to say, who's afraid of Batman's dick?
He was just in some of those intimate images, just avoiding nudity, so he managed to do it. But the weird thing is he's... The niche he's kind of carved out is that he's... He can be kind of... Tell serious... erotic stories, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Which is not, and that are not porn in any way.
Yeah, he can do relationship stories with
I hope he can do a good version of that story because I do not want a love story between Joker and Harley anymore.
Yeah, no, I don't think it'll be that.
Most people, I still get, you know, people who think that that is like the epitome of romance, and I'm kind of just like, no.
I think, and I almost feel a little bad for him because I sort of get the idea that they just want to sort of, a lot of times when they do the hashtag relationship goals, sort of imagine themselves as a wild couple. Yeah. I think that's really all it is.
Yeah.
But like, it'll, if it ends up covering up abuse or like they're fighting and stuff like that and they're like, we're just like Joker and Harley, I'm like, oh, it's not good.
No.
But I think that there, beyond just the retelling of the origin, I think there's like, he's got like a whole new kind of like plot arc that has something to do with a... kind of a new treatment she's got for the Arkham villains and stuff like that. So there's going to be some new elements in this, and it's not just going to be a retelling of this.
And
story.
Is this in the Black Label format,
it's
or
Black
it's three
Label.
Issue?
Yeah. Yep.
Three issues. Yeah.
Oh, are those all three issues?
Yeah.
Oh, I hadn't even realized. Yeah, Batman Damned, whenever it does complete, will be three. Superman's three, and it, of course his art is going to look great.
Yeah.
See, if you haven't seen his Stephen Sedgwick stuff. If you can by chance decipher his name or get Google to decipher it for you, go poke around his, I don't know, his Instagram page. Is Tumblr still around?
Yeah, Tumblr's around.
By the way, Batman White Knight, which was the first Black Label, was not in that format.
Because it wasn't a Black Label to begin with. It was its own thing, and they were like, oh, let's put a Black Label imprint on it. It'll be great.
They did that. Did they do that for New Frontier?
Yeah, they've retroactively made a couple of the bigger ones.
The Black Label is not a well-defined imprint.
No.
At all.
So this is called Harlene?
Harlene.
Yeah, people should sign up for it. I think it's going to be good.
All right, and lastly, a bit of news that made me shriek with terror. DC has announced that Legion of Superheroes is coming back, and that Brian Michael Bendis is going to be running it. It's apparently there's a two-issue miniseries called Legion of Superheroes Millennium, which is going to be a two-part book featuring some character and immortal protagonist moving through various DC futures. So we're going to see Bendis' take on OMAC, Commandy, Booster Gold, probably Space Cabby, I don't know.
Probably, I bet he's got Jonah Hex's
Tommy Tomorrow
thing.
Batman Beyond, a near-future Supergirl.
So what you're going to say is he is going to put his stamp on all of DC's future.
Yep. Artists involved include Jim Lee, Jim Chung, Nicola Scott, Dustin Nguyen. It's going to look very pretty. It's going to be almost unreadable. And then it's going to launch an ongoing Legion Superheroes book with Bendis and Ryan Suk. And all I can think is, what a waste.
Now that Randy's editorialization is out of the way, we should say, let's see, what has Bendis done at DC?
Action and Superman.
He's done Action and Superman, and he's overseen the...
Event Leviathan.
What's the Young Comics title?
Wonder Comics.
Wonder Comics, and he specifically co-wrote with David Walker,
Naomi.
Yep.
Yeah. These have all been pretty successful so far.
Yep.
Yeah, more or less. Soon he'll be writing Batman.
I could see...
We don't know that, right?
No, but it's...
Well, there's no way it's not going to happen during his run at some point.
Well, I just figure, you know...
With what's-his-name on the way out, they're going to need a big announcement to kind of...
I just think... The Superman Action Comics are good books, but I don't think they're selling... especially
it
amazing.
Big,
it was not the big thing that they were hoping for.
Right.
I think moving him to Batman, which is a more prominent character, makes most sense.
Well, it's also fits his, you know, one of his better runs at Marvel was Daredevil.
Yeah.
And Spider-Man, both of which are kind of, or Ultimate Spider-Man, both of which are more on that sort of power level.
Yeah.
I don't know, Nick, you probably are most likely to have some interest in this of us. Where you stand?
I mean, I'm going to read it. It doesn't excite me to see Bendis put his own take on, like, all those other characters, just because I think I have my versions that I want. I mean, I even have my favorite version of Legion. I mean, it's...
Yeah.
So I guess...
Is yours Abnett Lanning?
Yeah, I like the Abnett Lanning stuff a lot.
The weird thing is, Randy, you and I have talked over the years that like, we want... Like a new, we wanted like a really kind of big overhaul of Legion, you know, with that so that they don't look like 1950s white teens,
yep.
you know,
yep.
get some gender, race,
I will
diversity.
Say Bendis will do that.
And so here's the thing. He's going to do some of that,
he's going to
do
his
think.
Version of it. If you had announced, and I'm not even a huge fan of this writer, but if you had put Magdalene Visaggio on this book, if you had put even Gail Simone, like, someone... Give this book to someone who isn't a white dude. That's all I want.
Yeah.
Someone who's going to bring a different perspective. Because we've seen that perspective. And it's been done well. I liked enough of Mark Waid's. I love Jim Starlin's, or not Jim Starlin's.
Jim Shooter's?
Paul Levitz.
Or Paul Levitz, yeah.
Paul Levitz's right. run. I was just thinking old people.
Yeah, Jim Shooter did have a famous run because he was writing Religion famously when he was 13.
I loved the 90s stuff that Tom McCraw and Tom Pyre and Mark Waid did. Like, and I love the Evan and Lanning one. But it is time to give somebody a chance who has not previously written these characters, who's not an older man. Give an actual younger writer a chance to write this book.
Yeah.
Go find another 13-year-old. How hard could it be?
Or find another 13-year-old. How hard could it be?
It does seem like Legion, with its diversity of aliens and stuff like that, could really do to have some diversity amongst its writers. One thing, like, this is the 5 years later run that they did in the 90s, is a lot of Legion purists really don't like it, right?
So yeah, it was one of your favorites, though.
Yeah,
right?
I really liked it. But it was a very dystopian sort of spin on it. It was like Blade Runner had collided into their future.
I remember you had given me a couple of the, I think maybe like the first story arc in Single Issues to read, and I actually enjoyed that. I mean, I was a little lost with like character names and things like that.
Right,
I had to
they
be
weren't
like,
using code names. They were all just going by their real
I had to
weird
do a,
names.
Use a little Googling just to be like, okay, that's that person, that's that person.
What was Google for you was the DC RPG handbooks for
which is cool. I mean,
but,
that's a little bit cooler,
but the
actually.
Thing that I think that made that interesting, this was co-plotted by Keith Giffen and a husband and wife team, Tom and Mary Beerbaum. And I think that they actually did bring something to it as a couple that was kind of a unique voice.
Yeah.
The hook was really about the kind of the setting. It wasn't, but they did do like some, I mean, this is weird. The first character I remember being sort of a notable trans character in a comic was during that run.
Mm-hmm.
There was a reveal about one of the supporting characters. And they were trying to push some edges. And I think a Legion book, it's weird because a lot we think of Legion as this comfortable book, the same way classic Star Trek is comfortable.
Yeah,
and I think it needs a bit of edge right now.
It needs a Discovery overhaul.
Needs a Star Trek Discovery. Yeah, maybe so.
It does not need Bendis to come in and do his weird dialogue. I don't know. Don't get me wrong. I've been so desperate for Legion to return. I'm gonna read the first few issues.
It's gonna be like they're like I forget who was the main artist working with him on it. He talked about him the other day in one of the interviews I read. And I can't remember.
Wait, but the main artist working with him on Legion?
Ryan Sook. Ryan Sook. He's gonna design like great costumes. The characters are gonna look
Sook
super
is an amazing
cool.
artist.
Yeah, the costumes look good. The early stuff looks great.
Yeah. I would like for it to be good, but I haven't been able to. I'm trying to think of the last Bendis book I plugged into that wasn't just some anecdotal random issue.
Yeah.
And it's been a while.
I don't know.
Naomi, I guess he's co-writer on that.
And I and I connected with Action Comics quite a bit. Yep. So I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah.
Not excited, but I'm not
You're not
I will
ready
read
to
it.
Write it off
exactly.
just yet.
I am.
Randy.
And yet he's already said
it or
he
not,
will read the first couple
is ready
of issues.
To write it off.
And yet we'll definitely read the first issue.
You're Bendis' bitch.
All right, we'll be back in just a second to talk about comics for the last couple weeks.
One familiar cry.
We were talking comics week of June 12th and June 19th. And Dave, I believe you have the only number one at the table, so why don't you start us off?
Yeah, so this is actually a pick from last week since we did a skip week. We're allowing our choices to cross over there. This was Silver Surfer Black by Donny Cates, number one. You know, when the title was coming out, or when we were ordering it, I was like, oh, is this going to be part of the color series that Jeff Loeb did, like Spider-Man Blue and Daredevil Yellow and all that? It did not quite occur to me, and I guess Guardians of the Galaxy hadn't come out yet at the time, that it was because of the black hole that occurs in that. who was it? Was it, it was one of Thanos' minion people.
Proxima Midnight can open up black holes.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of the heroes that had gathered, which were a bunch of Marvel's cosmic types, were essentially plunged into a black hole to die. And that's where this starts. So the maybe before I even say what sort of where the story goes, I should quick mention the artist is Trad Moore, who
he's Strangetown of Luther Strode.
Yeah, well, which Luther I didn't Strode, read, yeah. But y'all did. He also did he did Ghost Rider at some point too.
Yeah, he
right?
did all new Ghost Rider.
That's right.
Yeah,
is he co-created? I think he did.
I think he did.
What's the name of that kid who became Ghost Rider?
Why would you put us all on the spot like that?
I just assumed you know. People who watch S.H.I.E.L.D. and stuff.
I didn't watch S.H.I.E.L.D. It's the debate watching.
I forget it.
I figured Nick would know.
Sorry, I let you down.
Anyway, so he was like, yeah, then co-creator of that. I really like his art, even though I haven't really followed him any stories before. He's a kind of trippy, bendy, very kinetic, but curvy artist. I don't know, like, quite how to pin it down. It almost, like, it has some of the psychedelia of Mike Allred, but it's...
Doesn't it have, like, some Ditko-ish to
yeah,
it as
I think
well?
That's a good, I think that's a good connection, too.
When I was reading it, it definitely reminded me of kind of a more updated Ditko.
And because there's also, like, literally spaces being bent and around in this, it has some of the weird exaggeration you would associate with, like, graffiti art, which I think was always informed his art, even in Strange Town of Luther Strode and all that
there's
stuff.
Definitely less blood in here than there is in the Strange Town of Luther Strode.
That's true. It's not the kind of hyper-violent, invincible-style thing that was. So, without saying too much about what happens here, essentially Silver Surfer kind of, like, uses the power cosmic to keep the from them being collapsed in the utter, you know, crushing power of a black hole, which is pretty cool. I think that is a power level worthy of him, is basically stopping a black hole.
I really liked how this book opens, with a sort of him kind of defining himself with different names.
Yeah, he's talking about how, like, amongst the worlds he goes to, he's basically seen as this harbinger of death.
It's like, I am Norn Rad, I am the harbinger, right. Galactus's herald.
Yep.
Then there's another name that very few people call him or something. It's like, I am death. Yeah. It's just this, like, kind of this heavy metal version of...
Well, you know, he's always had this kind of dark, angsty poet side.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He's not like a... He's like a super badass, but he's also... He's like a warrior poet guy. He's not a fighter who's, like, out there, like, tearing it up. He's not Space Lobo or whatever. He's a guy who, like, doesn't want to fight, but when he does, he will drop the hammer on you.
I feel like this is Donny Cates sort of embracing that, as opposed to where, like, Dan Slott was making it very much a Doctor Who kind of analog.
Donny Cates definitely has some metalhead to him. Oh. You don't create Cosmic Ghost Rider and write Venom without having some of that.
I agree.
But that said, I think he was fairly true to the character here, where he's not, like, you know, he is that kind of soulful warrior is kind of, you know, what he's doing here. And he lets Donny Cates lets the art talk a lot in this. This almost reminds me of, like, looking at old Ditko Doctor Strange comics where he's flying through, you know, eternity and, like, weird two-dimensional and three-dimensional are mixing and stuff like that. That's the vibe of the book. It says you're as much there for the visual aesthetic as you are for the story. But the story does ultimately come to, like, I forget if it's, like, actually a planet contained somehow within the black hole or not, but there's a planet he essentially arrives at and sort of immediately encounters these dangers there, and there's actually some very cool fighting going on there. He's using his board offensively, gliding it into people. Almost the way you kind of rethink stuff for animation, where you're like, oh, how would he fight with this? What would he be doing? And it ultimately, there's a kind of a, without saying too much else about the book, because I think this is kind of a, you experience this one. It's almost like you're surfing along beside him through this, all this trippiness. And it does feel like it could be heavy metal style, you know, like all about the visuals and animation. But it does, have a character that connects with another Donny Cates book. And I was like, oh, that's actually pretty neat. It's something that's on his level of power. And it's sort of a, I think it'll be a mythology that he's been building up. I think it's a kind of a cool idea. Anyway, what is this, 6 issues?
I don't know.
Somewhere in that ballpark.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm looking forward to more to come. I thought it was a good mind-bendy space adventure sort of thing. I think it was pretty true to the heart of what Silver Surfer is.
Speaking of Donny Cates, my pick is Guardians of the Galaxy number 6. And sometimes in a book, you just want to see action.
Mm-hmm.
And that is exactly what this issue is. It is sort of the culmination of the Thanos, rebirth of Thanos story arc.
There was a big mystery. There's been big mysteries as to, like, who Thanos cast his soul into.
Yep.
And essentially both the Guardians and, what do they call them? The Dark Guardians, I think is what they called them.
And then the Black Order, which is Thanos' crew. Hela is involved.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of stuff has happened with Gamora. So there's a lot of, like, big stuff has happened, but this is just kind of, let's just bash some skulls in. Yeah. And I have to appreciate that every once in a while. Jeff Shaw does a fun job with it. And I love seeing them work as a team.
The artist?
Yeah, Jeff Shaw is the artist. I like them working as a team together, showing, like, Betteray Bill working with Moondragon and sort of Phyla Vell showing up and messing with things and... I thought there were some notable stuff. I mean, notable stuff does occur in this one. Some big stuff.
Yeah, actually, kind of fun happens with the Cosmic Ghost Rider, too.
Yep. I think that is very interesting.
Yeah, it's sort of going to be to be continued in, like, another book, but I was like, oh, that's kind of a neat idea.
So, yeah, lots of fun stuff. Lockjaw gets used very well. He's a good Peppers.
Good dog, Lockjaw.
And I actually really like the relationship that Gamora and Peter Quill have. It's kind of unconventional. Not really, because Gamora is in such a bizarre place within the Marvel landscape right now.
Right. She's been, like, villainous. And
she had gone evil and commanded all the Infinity Stones and during Infinity Warps and all that other stuff, caused a lot of chaos. And she's sort of on the outs with everybody, but Peter is still kind of... I mean,
trying to back her up.
Back her up. He does love her. So there is that, but... Also, I mean, he's part of her crew. His crew. I mean, or she is part of his crew. So, I don't know. I thought it was good. Randy, what is your pick?
So, I'm once again picking Daredevil, number 7. This is the Chip Zdarsky's Daredevil run. He's doing an interesting thing in his second arc where basically Matt has quit being Daredevil. He's quit being a lawyer. He's a probation officer. It's working really... And, you know, we all know he's going to be Daredevil again.
Yeah.
But Zdarsky's doing a good job of sort of selling it as a... Matt has actually... changed his life and is pretty happy. He has a nice meeting with Foggy, and he remembers Foggy's birthday for only the second time ever, right? See, last time was right before he met Elektra. And there's also a big meeting in, like, a bank vault where Kingpin calls in all the various crime lords, including the Owl, and talks to them, and they're all talking about how, well, you know, things are going great. As long as we don't get in each other's territory, you know, there's plenty for everybody. And Kingpin basically announces he's stepping away from crime. He says, I'm going to be mayor. New adventures for me. You guys, I'm going to distribute the people from my criminal empire to you. You treat them well. And so it's basically like Daredevil and Kingpin have both quit. And I don't know where the story goes from here. It's obviously...
It's going to be one chill New York. Everybody's just relaxing. The Owl, maybe the Owl can become a painter.
But it's really interesting to see Matt, sort of Matt is struggling with his guilt about what he did. You know, he basically killed someone, and that's what's caused him to stop being Daredevil. Mm-hmm. And he's dealing with the repercussions of all his violence over the years. And I don't know how he goes back to being Daredevil after this. I'm sure that Zdarsky will find a way. But it's a very interesting story arc. My backup pick is a hardcover. The Rolled and Told Volume 1 came out this week, and it is spectacular. This is, I think, the first, like, 6 or 7 issues of the mixture of comics and D&D material that Lion Forge has been doing. It has 7 full adventures, 6 mini adventures, 4 pre-made character sheets, 18 articles, which are everything from Seafarer and Buccaneers objects to random books to, like, how to run gaming while poor, expanding your gaming while without spending money, which, as a game store owner, I am not in favor of course. But it's a really good book. It's got a ton of great art. And it is I'm super excited to dig into this and use it for gaming. Even if you don't game, this is one of those for people who always wanted to play D&D, don't have a group. This will give you the sense of what you're missing from D&D.
Well, you know, when I was a kid, I didn't play D&D, but I would read my brother's Dragon magazines. And like, I would read the adventures. And yeah, I kind of got the vicarious, surfing what D&D was through that.
Yeah.
And I'm happy to see something like that come back into the fold.
Dave, what's your backup pick?
Backup pick is Clue Candlestick, number 2. Clue Candlestick was the trippy indie movie director, is it Dash Shaw? as well. And he's also the artist on this. He's story, art, and lettering, all of the above. It has the complete feel of, like, almost like a Fantagraphics comic, is like, or like drawn in quarterly. Yeah. It is like an art house take on Clue. This issue focuses on what is her name?
Miss Scarlet.
Who is and how her story intersects with Mr. Body, and it's got all these musings on art, colors, and you know the color philosophy.
It is a very artsy book.
Yep. They open with the opening six panels are just solid colors with text over them, just to give you an example, and they're all about how certain colors were linked to death. So one says, lead white was used in European easel painting until the 1800s when it was banned for its poisonous content. Still, I have a tube of it I use for special works.
Yeah.
That's the artist who's painting her. And he's like, green pigments were also very poisonous. Emerald green was used in wallpapers and dresses, causing many deaths. Anyway, they go through this strange history of it, but there's also, she sort of has a femme fatale thing going on where it seems like she's been murdering various artists who used her as a muse. And there's, like, actually some interesting thoughts in here on artists who are very egotistical but discard the inspirations for their art in them.
Hmm.
Sounds
clever.
It is, and it has the same... There is that same weird Clue iconography that it uses in here. Like, it will pause the comic in the middle and ask you, like... It says, one page has a bunch of, like, weird, like, sort of cutouts and patterns, almost like a police lineup of comic clip art.
Yeah.
And it says, without turning back to the previous page, see if you can identify the murderer. This will test your observational skills. He was in the middle of the three men in the auto shop. Like, you'll remember the panel from just literally the page right before. The thing is, I think he's just kind of just being fun with this because it doesn't seem to have any real bearing on the story. I don't know how much this will actually function in any way as a whodunit. It's really much more of a sort of like an exploration of these strange characters. Very Wes Anderson's Clue or something like that.
Yeah, for sure.
If I had to say it in a pinch, that's what I'm going to use.
Well, I like that they're doing something different with Clue. Like, taking the ideas, because, I mean...
I really like it. I believe it's only going to run one more issue, which I think is good, because I do feel that this approach could overstay its welcome.
Yeah.
But I've loved the two issues so far, and would look forward to revisiting them. I'll definitely be buying the trade at this point, unless they just completely bungle it in the final issue, which I don't think is going to happen. Nick, your second pick?
I am picking Faithless number 3. Faithless is a weird book. And it's very
a naughty comic.
It is a naughty comic.
Why'd you pick a dirty comic?
But it's sort of about sex, magic, corruption, demons, the devil, even. Yeah. And there's just something about it that it's not lurid. I mean, it is very.
It's a little lurid.
I mean,
But here's the thing: it's not lurid in like. It's lurid in a... Like, the artist is great, for one thing.
I mean...
It's almost in a different, very different way from, say, Stefan Sedgwick's Sunstone, which is a lurid book, but also a smart book.
Yeah.
This is a somewhat lurid book that's also a smart book.
Yeah. The art is by Maria Lovett, and her...
It's amazing.
It's beautiful. And she kind of captures both the mundane, the sexy, and also the very violent and... kind of demon stuff with the same level of detail and a unique eye.
There's certain crossover with some of like Eduardo Rizzo, like who's worked with Azzarello before. Yeah, Paul Pope. Even like artists like Alex Toth and stuff like that.
Yeah.
The sort of the way heavy areas of black are sometimes used, but like the it's one of those. She's like a stunningly good artist.
Yeah, and the first issue was kind of like, okay, I don't know where this is going. The second issue kind of opened it up a little bit more. And it's every issue is opening it more up, and I'm like, okay, I can sort of see where we're going finally.
It's that Azzarello puzzle box style.
It is, and I'm liking it with more and more with every issue. I am very curious to see where this person's story continues to downward spiral, because I don't think she's going to end up in a great spot.
No.
But... it's a very interesting story to watch play out.
It's interesting because it's not quite horror, but it's more like kind of weird occult suspense erotica.
It reminds me of kind of Rosemary's Baby kind of horror. Very Roman Polanski-ish.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I'm quite digging it.
It is, in its strange way, thoughtful.
Yeah.
What else you got on your stack?
I've only got two other ones. So Batman 73, which sees a conversation between alternate Earth, thought dead, but Flashpoint Thomas Wayne and Bruce Wayne.
Yep. So it's Bruce and his dad, but his alternate Earth dad who became Batman.
Correct.
And was crazy, evil?
He's not crazy, nor is he evil, though he was working he's with ruthless. Bane.
Yeah, he's more like Red Hood, I guess. Yeah.
So there is kind of an ulterior motive of why he was working with Bane, and it's very interesting, and if it does go where it is going, I can see why DC got cold feet.
Oh, interesting. We might be starting to get our first indications of what made them freak out about Tom King's direction.
If Tom King really wants to do this and wanted to do it, I can kind of see why people might have second thoughts.
I will be questioning you off mic as soon as we're done.
But it was very interesting, beautifully rendered by Michael Janin. He's really one of the best artists in the business. And the only other book I have on my pile is Superman Year One, which is the Black Label by Frank Miller and John Romita Jr. And it's sort of Frank Miller's, you know, origin story for Superman and his life in Smallville.
Yeah.
And it is, I mean, it's definitely Frank Miller. There's no way around his sort of...
It's not noir like that, but it's got his kind of first-person, slightly noirish beats.
Yes.
Even though it is still all kind of, like, Smallville.
But there is also some, like, wholesome, normal stuff that occurs in this. It's not like the blood ran red in Smallville things like that.
It's only his terse narrative style.
Yeah.
His short, little punctuated
bursts. And I actually thought, like, you know, him growing up and dealing with, like, bullies was actually really well handled here as opposed to where I was thinking. So, I mean, John Romita Jr.'s artwork was great.
Yeah, he's good at drawing, like, regular folks.
Yeah. I'm curious to see, because this is, like, his younger days.
Yep.
And towards the end, it gets to Clark Kent in a much different place than I think I've seen him before. Mm. So I'm curious to see what, like, a, you know, 20-something Clark Kent in the Navy might be.
Yeah.
So I liked it. I wasn't in love with it, but I thought it was fun.
That's around where I was. And I also, a quick mention, I thought it had a kind of cool opening sequence that's a, not quite this, but almost essentially the destruction of Krypton told from, seen through the eyes of the infant Kal-El as it, like, kind of all comes around behind him. And there's sort of narration that sort of it suggests his impulses as it's, things are being destroyed. But then it follows him through to space, all the way through to Earth. You know, it's like 10 pages or so, almost from his perspective.
I think if you're a Superman fan, you definitely should check it out.
Dave, what else on your stack?
I want to recommend the second issue of Terry Moore's 5 Years. I don't think anybody but me is reading this, but I like it. It's his own book that has the in-continuity Strangers in Paradise, Echo, Rachel Reborn, Rachel Rising, and all that stuff.
It's a shared universe.
It's his weird own shared universe. Teen Titans 31, Anna's got me following this book, written by Adam Glass from... Adam Glass?
Yeah.
From Supernatural, among other things. And I'm kind of liking it. Crush, the daughter of Lobo, comes face-to-face with her dad in this. And Lobo just comes in and just wrecks the Teen Titans.
I think that is actually what should happen. Lobo is, like, super powerful.
Yeah, he is, like a deadbeat dad who seems to be unrepentant. But there is, like, some mysteries. Like, he didn't know she existed. I think that is it for me as far as what I've read.
All right, well, this week, there's Usagi Yojimbo, which gets a new number one from IDW, is... Oddly, just like another issue of Usagi Yojimbo, it's full color, but it is a story of him. There's a demon hunter. There's a puppetry. Since Tensukai always likes to do, he's done one about tea ceremonies, all this kind of stuff, about sort of Japanese culture stuff. It's, I don't know, great it's going to be for new readers. Hopefully they'll still enjoy it, because it is still very new reader approachable. But it's another great issue of Usagi, which I'm glad to see in color.
Yeah.
Valiant launches Psylords, which is their sort of big cosmic epic. There's four humans who have superpowers. It's a big galactic prison break. Spider-Man City at War number 4 is more of the video game adaptation, which has been really, really good, nicely filling in little gaps of the story, following the story that I thought was really good, and they're going to do a follow-up that is a original story set in the video game universe, and I'm very excited about that because I think that's a really interesting continuity.
We were talking about how Tom Taylor's work on Injustice might have paved the way for something like that, sort of more serious video game universe explorations.
Yeah, and then from last week, I just want to mention that Friendly Neighborhood Spider-Man number 7 is out and has the Prowler in it, and then Immortal Hulk number 19, that continues to be one of my favorite books. That's it for comics this week. Back in just a second, talk about the Great Austin Comic Con and maybe a couple other things.
Talking about comics, movies, and fame. They even talk about board games. No week is the same.
All right, so this weekend was the Greater Austin Comic Con, their second year, our first year there.
Yep.
We brought in Larry Hama, which was very exciting because we're all big G.I. Joe fans.
Yep. I got a cool sketch of him of Quinn, the Eskimo mercenary from G.I. Joe, who was in the first issue of G.I. Joe I ever read, which happened to be G.I. Joe number 2. Yep.
And I met him for about 5 seconds.
Yep.
Busy all weekend.
A quick interesting side story. Somebody kind of randomly came over to him, I think not really knowing who he was, younger comic artist.
They just saw
artist.
A guy who was like...
Well, somebody had said, you should go talk to Larry, like one of the other people at a booth. This guy had a sketchbook of like talented amateur sketches. And I was like, at a quick glance, I was like, this actually looks pretty good. This guy's like, I could see him, you know, getting picked up for a comic book or something like that. But like, there was no like sort of storytelling in him. And the writer that Hama was working with was there. And the kid said, he's like, do you have a sketchbook you'd like to take a look at? And because I think he just kind of wanted general input on how do you get into the business? Yeah. What should I do next? And the guy said, do you have a thick skin? And I think the kid, I presume, said yes, because he handed him his book. And then I listened to Larry Hama and them talk about it, and I've always heard that, like some of those old-school guys, like because Hama was an editor, they will give you some harsh reviews. He gave him a harsh one. And it was good. It was the same kind of thing, like, if anybody's ever read the Alex Toth talking to Steve Rude stuff, it was like that. It was like a don't fake this stuff, learn to draw everything. You need to draw like 100,000 drawings to get any good at all, so you might as well start drawing as fast as you can, as many as you can, and all this. But it was interesting to hear, and it was good advice. I don't know if that kid was ready for it. I say kid, he was probably like 18 or 20.
This is a 6-year-old, his face falling.
Oh my god! It's like his drawing that he drew for the refrigerator.
Yeah, he's like, what is this kid? Was it three arms? This is crap. You're crap.
Was the kid crying?
No.
Yeah, well, that's good.
He survived it. He seemed to take it in stride. Anyway, but it was kind of cool to see that because, like, Hama is, like, both... He's been an editor for forever. He worked with Wally Wood back in the day and, like, Neil Adams. Like, he's worked with all these legends. And he's a tough editor. And he's, of course, a talented artist himself.
We were also there with, I think it's the 788th, is the G.I. Joe cosplay group.
Yep.
They were across the way. They had a full Fang copter.
Oh, man. There were so many awesome costumes in there. I saw a dude there as Breaker, Beachhead.
Scarlet.
Scarlet. Snake Eyes and Storm Shadow, of course.
Yep.
Did we say Shipwreck? Shipwreck was in there.
Lifeline.
Hawk.
Lifeline.
General Hawk.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, the Lifeline guy was excellent. Oh, and of course, Outback.
Yeah. Yeah, and there were a bunch of Red Ninjas, like... It was impressive cosplay.
Yeah, seeing them all together, I'm like, man, G.I. Joe had some great design sense, and these guys have done a fantastic job on all their costumes.
I think the cosplay was kind of my favorite part of the con. We saw a lot of people walking by in awesome costumes. It was a Skeksis.
Yeah,
I saw that.
There was the, what's it, Ikumi? Death Note?
The demon from Death Note, yeah.
Which was, like, towering. It was, like, 10 feet tall.
Yeah, he had, like, some kind of crazy stilt thing going on and, just, like, was a palpably creepy presence.
Yeah, one of my friends who was with us, she's a huge fan of Death Note. She got a picture with it. She was super happy about it.
Among my favorites was little kid playing as Captain America. Like, he was, like, this kid was, like, 5 or 6 or something like that, and he had the hammer and the shield.
Yep.
Barf. From Spaceballs, who was, I believe, one of our customers, and he did a great job.
Did you see the little creepy Pennywise kid?
Yes, that may be the best costume I've ever seen on a kid. It was a dead ringer for the current Pennywise look.
Scary.
And doing lots of pictures with, like, other kids and stuff. If he did not win the costume contest for the kids, I don't know what kind of world we're living in.
Yeah. It was fun. We had a good time.
Yeah, yeah.
I want to talk about... I also finally got a chance to go see the live-action Aladdin.
Oh, yeah.
Which I know Dave has seen. Nick, have you seen
it? Yeah, I saw.
Yeah, we talked about it while you tuned out.
Oh, right. Okay, you guys did talk about it. So, I didn't listen to anything you guys said because I wanted to not know anything.
Yep.
I really, really liked it. I thought they did a phenomenal job updating it for sort of the little bit of the cultural sensitivity that wasn't really maybe lacking in 90s Aladdin, but they didn't lose what made Aladdin. Like there's a lot of the
major beats you're going to know. Yeah. He's going to still sing A Whole New World with Jasmine.
Yep, that was a great scene.
But you know one thing I liked? I'll give you an example of a change-up that I'm curious to hear what you thought about it. His one jump song where he's running from the city guards, it's with Jasmine now.
Yeah, I like that a lot. The only thing I didn't like is in the movie, in the original, Jasmine goes vaulting past him on the pole.
Yeah.
And she's like the super accomplished, he's surprised. In this one, he has to talk her through it.
Right.
But it fits because she's so more sheltered and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
They gave her a song. They gave her a little more of an arc, which I really liked. And the big question was always going to be, can Will Smith cut it as the genie? And he's great. He's not Robin Williams. Nobody could be.
Right. But you tune in for the person who's playing the role, and they let him be Will Smith.
They found his strengths. There's even a rap at the end.
Yes. I didn't mention it, but yes, there's a rap at the end.
Also, the Make Way for Prince Ali.
Yeah.
Is more impressive in live action than it was in animation.
That's his big showpiece in there. And he gets to ham it up really, really entertainingly.
Yep.
That's the best song in the entire movie.
It's pretty great as far as the lineup. I like their Jafar. I think their Iago is pretty weak, but you can match Gilbert Gottfried's Iago.
Well, their Iago was actually there just almost as a sort of snarky sounding board because he didn't actually talk. Yeah. He just did parrot stuff, which is to say he would say smart alecky stuff occasionally.
Voiced by Alan Tudyk.
Oh, is that who voiced it? Okay. Yeah. And it was good. I was skeptical and like everybody else. Also, the framing sequence thing. I really liked. I did not see that coming, and I should have.
Oh, did you not see what the deal was?
I didn't pick it up. When they first started, I'm like, oh, this is cute. It's a little thing where they're doing a thing where Will Smith is telling the story. That's cute. I didn't see the wraparound coming, and I'm that was really clever.
Yeah,
I liked the little added arc that they gave the genie. It just kind of, instead of him just being generically freed, he kind of has a goal.
Yeah. Well, and also Nassim Pedrad, who plays the handmaiden, that's an additional character, and I really liked her.
Yep.
She was in John Mulaney's show. She's great.
And so I didn't know who she was, and Mandy, who I saw it with, told me it was she was from SNL, too.
Yeah, yeah.
And so she sent me a bunch of sketches with her, and I saw she was really funny.
She's really funny. I really like her. So.
Yeah,
it was really great.
It's probably in my top two or three of I think for me, Jungle Book is my favorite of their live action.
Sure,
And this is probably right after it.
And then, Nick, I finally caught up on Always Be My Maybe on Netflix, which is a romantic comedy with
Randall Park
and Ollie Wong. Yeah, and Keanu Reeves.
With a guest appearance by Keanu Reeves playing himself,
Playing a heightened version of himself. What's amazing is that he's he is clearly a dick for Randall Park's character. He's this great guy who took this woman. And there's this sort of this underlying thing of maybe his niceness is a little bit snarkier than we see.
Yeah.
But in the same way, it is played as if he is just a genuinely such a super nice guy that if you are not a god among men, you want to punch him in the face. I really loved that take on him, and I love that he was game enough to play along with it.
Yeah, I wasn't sure about this one because it just popped up on Netflix like all these movies do, and I was like, another romantic comedy. Some of these are good, some of these are kind of bad.
Yeah.
But Randall Park and Ali Wong being involved, and they actually wrote it.
Yeah.
I forget who directed it. But it was sort of this kind of just smashing of all these people. And I love Randall Park. I think he's hilarious. His comedic timing is always great.
Also, Michelle Buteau?
Oh, who plays Randall's girlfriend?
No, plays her best friend.
Oh, yeah, she's great.
The songs that Randall Park's band do are really catchy.
Yeah, he he's got a good voice.
Yeah, and I love the arc with his dad.
Yeah.
There's a lot of really good stuff in there. Her sort of chefy thing always is an interesting thing. I thought this was a really fun romantic comedy.
It is. It's definitely worth your time watching. I don't know. I like romantic comedies. It's always been sort of a genre that I've enjoyed, and it's nice to see a couple just pop up that are still really good instead of being super schlocky.
And then you and I both watched The Chef Show.
Yes.
Have you watched all of it?
I did.
So this is Jon Favreau, who made the movie Chef a few years back.
Yep.
He did all his training on that movie with Chef Roy Choi.
Yep.
Who's did one of the first food trucks in LA. And somehow they just got together. It sounds like they got together and started making a show about cooking without having anywhere they were going to put it.
Yeah, no, like, I think they were just wanting to get back together and do something fun, and then they were like, oh, we can actually make a show about this. We can Netflix will do it.
And of course they can, because it's like, the first episode has Gwyneth Paltrow in it. The second one is them sitting down to a meal with, like, everyone from the MCU. So it's like the Russo brothers and Kevin Feige and Tom Holland and Tony Stark.
Yeah.
Robert Downey Jr. And it's kind of crazy that they just all, like, talk about food and talk about what food was like in England for... And what Brexit's going to do for English food. Like, all this interesting stuff.
Yeah, it felt more organic and just a bunch of friends getting together and sort of just having a conversation. And it's that's endearing.
But he also goes to, like, other chefs' restaurants and sees how they make things.
Yeah.
There's an episode where they remake all the recipes from Chef, where they make the chocolate lava cake, where they make the grilled cheese, they make the pasta, all that kind of stuff. The
Cuban sandwich.
And I like there's a little sort of... It's not claymation. It's like CGI looking like claymation.
Yeah, which is just the truck from Chef.
They show the food truck, and then they bounce on the inside, and it, like, bounces... And the ingredients, like, explode out and get labeled. It's a really, really cool little way to show you.
And then, of course, it visits a lot of the same locations that Chef did well. Several of those are actually in Austin with, like, Robert Rodriguez.
Yeah.
Which I actually thought that episode was really cool, watching Robert Rodriguez, who, I mean, I would die if I could have a wood-burning oven.
In my house. Pizza oven. Yes.
In my house, yes. Yeah. I think that would be amazing. I would have pizza all the time.
Yeah, well, the Austin stuff is great because they talk to Aaron Franklin and they see how Franklin Barbecue works.
It is crazy how down to earth Aaron Franklin is, and I've actually heard him on several podcasts, and that's him.
Yeah,
I mean, he's really just kind of there.
Oh, our mutual friend Chris knows him. I mean,
yeah,
he's always been a good guy. It's interesting to see Jon Favreau, like, he clearly learned his chefing stuff.
Yeah.
Like, several people from Roy Choi to Aaron Franklin to some of the other chefs are like, yeah, you've got good knife skills.
Yeah.
Like, he trims a brisket with Aaron Franklin, and Franklin's impressed by it.
I think, like, at one episode, Dave Chang comes in, who's go watch Ugly Delicious. It's a lot of fun. And he tries one of Jon Favreau's dishes that's, like, made with, like, cauliflower instead of rice.
Yeah,
and he's like,
this is good.
This is really good. Did you really make this?
Yeah.
Favreau's picked up some skills.
Yeah, and the way Favreau talks, you can tell this guy, like, he must cook a lot now. Like, Chef, either he always did that, or Chef put that in him, but
he talks about cooking for his family a lot, and I think that's a big deal for him.
There's a love for cooking, there's a love for food, and there's a love for restaurants, and it's really, really engaging. I was super happy to watch it. It reminded me of it. Made me want to rewatch Chef again.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah. All right, that'll wrap it up for us this week. We'll be back next week with more. Until that time,
Yo, Joe!
Thanks for listening. If you like the show, do us a favor and spread the word to your friends. Or give us a quick 5-star rating and review on iTunes to help us grow our audience. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or at www.roguesgallerytx.com. We'll be back next week.